This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to America Secret Wars, the podcast all about the forgotten, overlooked, and deliberately covered up times the United States has used military force to fight or occupy foreign soil. I'm your host, Trevor Cully, and today I have our first returning guest, Roberto from the History of Socratvelo, Georgia and Czar Power podcasts.
Howdy.
How are you doing, Roberto?
I am fine and dandy. It is freaking hot outside.
See, it's actually cooled down quite a bit here because I'm getting hit by Hurricane Beryl's outer rainstorms right now.
Yeah, my family got hit by the actual hurricane, so...
Texas, that Houston, sounds like it yeah. sucks.
It does. They're like, we still don't have internet. And I'm like, I'm glad I'm not down south anymore. But yeah, it is a nice balmy 88 degrees. So if you hear some fans on my end, that is, apologies. Hopefully Trevor can mute it out, but, I'm a Southern boy. We don't do well in the heat,
which seems wrong for some reason.
We have ACs blasting like all the time.
And before you had AC, best not to talk about it.
Yeah.
All right, so you've already done the what was your relationship to history like in high school sort of question. So since you're a returning guest, I still want to do a bit of a history baseline here. What do you know about 19th century East Asia?
Not too much. I know about the Tokugawa Restoration. That's about it.
I did an episode about that with my brother a couple weeks ago.
I listened to it. It was great. Then I think I kind of know about stuff in like China, and that's honestly, Asia's not my forte. All I know about, you know, Asia tends to be Japan because I was a weeb back in high school. So, and still today, I will admit that on air.
Yeah, well, I think that is the thing with this whole series of episodes that we're doing here is that Americans tend not to know a whole lot about East Asian history. And if they do, it's probably post-World War II. And if it goes back any further than that, it's almost definitely going to be Japanese because we sort of occupied them for decades.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree with that. And plus, it's just like, where does anime come from? Give me the anime.
Yeah. Slightly more recent, but China does have a film and TV industry and animation styles of its own. There's plenty of stuff out there.
I lived there for 2 years. It's not great.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
now that I'm not censored, I can say that.
So I'm going to just assume that you've heard about the location of today's Secret Wars based on that. Because today we're going to China.
Oh, you know, I know a little bit about that place. Yeah, I was there from 2018 to 2020. I left February 2020 for a few reasons. I guess you can guess why.
Good time to get out.
Oh, yeah.
Good time to get out of wherever you were.
Yeah, I was in Beijing and then left on Valentine's Day, had to quarantine for 2 weeks in the U.S. 4 days later after my quarantine ended, shut down in the U.S. So it's my fault. I brought COVID to the U.S.
All right, we found him. Patient zero. Roberto ate the bat.
Yeah, no, I actually didn't even get COVID until a year later, so that was fun.
Well, I'm going to hazard a guess that there is basically nobody alive that doesn't know that America and China have a bit of a rivalry today, and that we've been scaremongering about an incoming war between our countries since, like, the mid-80s.
I mean, there was that remake of the Red Dawn movie. Weren't they, like, Chinese, or were they just Korean? I don't remember.
So I followed the production of that movie kind of closely because I was extremely entertained by it at the time. It was supposed to be China, but then they wanted to be able to release the movie in China. So they edited all of the signage in the movie to be in Korean and voiced over the actors to say that they were fighting North Korea, even though they filmed the entire movie on the premise that it was going to be Chinese.
That's why I thought they were like, oh, this is about China, because it was supposed to be.
Because it was, yeah.
Yeah.
Because neither's realistic, but China invading the United States is way more likely than North Korea.
Yeah, and I still think we'd kick their ass beforehand, but
I mean, we would just nuke each other into dust.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, we would all just become nuclear powder. It doesn't, there's no winner. Well, we're not talking about that war that hasn't and probably won't ever happen.
This is the Boxer Rebellion?
It's not the Boxer Rebellion, and it's not the Korean War, which was mostly a U.S.-Chinese war. But none of those are the first time that the U.S. of A. came to blows with China. Today, we are talking about the Opium War.
Wait, the U.S. is in that?
Yeah, we're especially going to focus on the Second Opium War, which was 1856 to 1860. But we were there for a little bit of the first one, and Americans have been involved in China for just about as long as the United States has been a thing that exists.
So we just really want to get everyone high, is what I'm hearing.
Oh, Roberto, you have no idea.
Can't wait. Pass the bong.
Today it's a pipe. It's an opium pipe.
Well, pass it anyways.
First, I should acknowledge two of the big sources that I used while writing this episode. One is Gold Braid and Foreign Relations, the Diplomatic Activities of U.S. Naval Officers, 1798 to 1883, by David Foster Long. This is a book that will be a recurring feature of my bibliography for basically anything dealing with the Navy in the 19th century. And Opium Wars, The Addiction of One Empire and the Corruption of Another, by W. Travis Haynes and Frank Sinello.
I thought you were about to say Frank Sinatra. I was like, oh, Frank Sinatra. Oh, damn it.
His little-known side gig as a historian of 19th century China.
I mean, why not? As you can tell, I'm a huge fan of the guy. If you look at my background.
Oh, yeah. Roberto has a Sinatra poster directly behind him.
Yes.
On camera. So, China as it exists both today and in the 19th century has a very, very, very long and complex history that we quite simply do not have time to get into.
Oh, come on, start from the beginning.
Go listen to Chris Stewart's excellent The History of China podcast. I do not have time to explain anything about the Mongols.
Yeah, that's gonna be fun to cover too.
Oh, right. Yeah. You are approaching.
I am approaching the Mongols. I am 6 or 7 people away.
Well, any day now.
Starting with Genghis.
Fortunately, I can skip straight to the 1800s today because that's what I actually care about. Large numbers of Europeans started arriving in China and East Asia in general in the form of Portuguese merchants and pirates in the 14 and 1500s.
Then it all went to hell.
And then white people arrived. This is always the problem, I'm telling you. And if you've listened to almost every episode of the show so far, except for the last one Roberto was on, the problem is, and then white people arrived.
On the one I was on, there were all white people.
Yeah. The Portuguese took an approach of, we have the blessing of the Pope, and all these people in the East aren't even Christian, we can do whatever we want. China quickly corrected that misunderstanding by beating the Portuguese pirates in their waters militarily, but there was so much Western interest in Chinese trade that the reigning Ming dynasty actually leased the entire city of Macau to Portugal, a colony that the Portuguese hung on to for over 400 years. It only returned to direct-ish Chinese control in 1999, much like Hong Kong as a one-country, two-systems polity. But Macau has more money, and they get away with the two-systems thing a little bit more.
If you want to go gambling, head on to Macau. That's what it's known for.
That is what it exists for.
Bling, 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 bling.
It is somehow richer and more ostentatious Chinese Vegas, if anybody doesn't know the reputation of Macau.
Yes, do not go there if you are on a small budget, because you cannot afford anything in there. It is the rich man's playpen, and it looks cool. Don't do it.
So from there, the Dutch turned up in greater numbers in the 1600s, and before long, all of the big European empires were getting in on the action. Now, this was an interesting moment in Chinese history. When the Ming dynasty collapsed into a brief period of competing powers before the Qing, an ethnically Manchu dynasty, as in Manchuria, the northeast of modern China, swept in and took over. There was immediately ethnic and cultural tension between the new Manchu ruling class and the Han majority. Adding European merchants and missionaries still working through the Catholic-Protestant split at the time was just another vector for cultural tension to spread within China. So between the hesitancy to let these new arrivals in, a surge in piracy, and rebellions, both the Ming and Qing governments intermittently shut down foreign trade altogether, or banned foreign merchants from most Chinese ports.
How dare they? They're going to get in trouble for that.
Well, there wasn't much the Europeans felt like they could do in the 16 and 1700s.
Oh, that's where we are at. Okay.
Yeah. After about a century of the Europeans pestering them about it, the Qing government relented and allowed specifically all non-Russian merchants from other countries into Guangzhou.
Wait, now I don't know why not the Russians, but I can also assume there's a few reasons for that.
Because they were nearby, basically.
Yeah, what?
They had a land border at this point.
Yeah, I guess I can see why they're mad now. You said 1700s?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, this is the time where Russia's expanding. I was going to say, we're expanding. Wait. Now I understand why.
Yeah, so there's tensions with Russia, and also they just have other more direct routes into China. Mm-hmm. They don't need to go all the way to the southern coast in Guangzhou.
Also,
I should note that English sources, up until very recently, always called this city Canton, based on a Portuguese attempt to pronounce Guangzhou. The audience might recognize this as very similar to Japanese policies under the Tokugawa shogunate from the previous couple of episodes. This is because Japan was directly mimicking this so-called Canton system.
Wait. So Canton, like Cantonese, comes from Guangzhou.
Yes.
What the fuck? I never knew that. What the fucking hell? That's crazy. All because white people couldn't pronounce something, yeah. We had to rename it. Guangzhou isn't even that hard to say.
No, it's not. But this was also the era of trying to transliterate names more into the style of the language you're speaking, which is why a bunch of Juans in Spain become Johns in English. It's a whole thing. It's also where we get the name, or where English got the name Formosa for Taiwan. In the last episode I put out, was trying to go through Portuguese intermediaries.
Interesting.
This is all stuff that's only really been worked out in the last, like, 50 years.
That's interesting. I never knew that Canton was Guangzhou. That is fascinating.
And so this system of limiting which ports, which countries could trade in was called the Canton mm-hmm. system, or the Canton system. Through all of this, there was one really big problem for European merchants looking to get involved in Chinese markets. China had a ton of stuff that Europeans wanted. They had silk and porcelain and tea, most of all. But the Europeans didn't really have anything that the Chinese wanted to buy.
Well, it, you know, when you're an isolated country, it kind of helps, doesn't it?
Well, to the Europeans, they were expecting to be like, well, we have these exotic goods from the far west, because you're so far away and have unique things, obviously you'll be interested in our far away things. And the Chinese were just like, no.
I mean,
Europeans could not find a product to sell in Chinese markets.
Delicious Chinese food, gray gruel from Europe. I can see why.
Now, Roberto, you've got to understand, they couldn't even get the Chinese hooked on tobacco.
Oh, it worked out eventually.
Yeah. Well, that's where we're headed.
Yes.
That was one of the big things that the Europeans, especially the British, wanted to get out of China.
Oh, I was going to say, they really wanted their chai tea lattes.
Yes.
Their tea latte.
big European delicacy in 1700. But for about the first 300 years of European trade with China, Western merchants were just bringing literal boatloads of silver, largely from slave mines in Spanish colonies in South America. And this was awesome for China, but not really how the European powers were used to doing business with far-off people they saw as non-Christian, non-white, and therefore lesser beings. They wanted to barter. They just didn't have anything worth bartering, and therefore had to actually spend money in trade.
Oh, that's horrible. Actually having to spend your money for stuff. That's like the worst. I hate doing it. I'm sure you do too.
I do hate spending money.
But subscribe to Patreon.
And so that I can spend more money, you should go to hopfulmedia.com.co and subscribe to get exclusive benefits.
Oh, yes. Fourth wall now. There we go. I'm sorry.
Yeah. See, we tricked them and they all thought it was going to be an ad, but it wasn't.
We are the ad.
So in most of Asia and the Americas and Africa, Europeans bartered. But China already had guns. They invented them. They had their own produce that they preferred. They had their own alcohol.
It's not that great. Don't drink baijiu.
They had all of the staples of colonial trade natively because they were an established ancient empire. And on top of all this, the tight restrictions on trade in Guangzhou were all managed and monitored by a group of merchants called the Kahong, who charged massive fees to do business in their port. And since their only consistent export was bulky precious metals, Europeans couldn't really smuggle things into Guangzhou either.
Oh, good old smuggling.
Of course, merchants wouldn't bother sailing halfway around the planet to buy luxury goods if it didn't turn a profit. But God damn it, these were good European Christian colonizers. They had a right to even bigger profits.
Wait, wait. Do good European Christian colonizers even go in the same, like, sentence?
They did in 1800.
Press X for doubt.
But speaking of profit, this is going to be the actual ad break, because it is time to embrace the horrors of international trade and global capitalism with whatever products, services, or podcasts come next.
Buy your Cinnamon Coke now. Cinnamon Coke, coming back to your store soon.
See, it's a good bit because you're doing it.
Yes.
In his final days, Alexander the Great's generals asked him who should succeed him. Alexander's answer, the strongest. Taken literally, this would see the close of the classical Greek age, an age thousands of years in the making. Join me, Mark Selleck, as I go back to retell the story of ancient Greece in my series Casting Through Ancient Greece. We will cast our way back to its beginnings, all the way through to the spread of its culture throughout the known world, thanks to Alexander and his generals. You can listen and subscribe to the series at www.castingthroughancientgreece.com, or you can listen on your favourite podcasting platform. Don't forget to follow the series over on Twitter at Casting Greece or on Facebook at Casting Through Ancient Greece. I look forward to seeing you there.
And we are back.
Well, I hope that was a good commercial.
I am sure it was. It might have been for your podcast.
Honestly, probably.
So we were talking about the struggles of European trade with China in the beginning of the 1800s. And this is around the time when they realized they had potential with a little round flower on a grayish-green stem called Papaver somniferum, better known as the opium poppy.
Milk of the poppy!
And Game of Thrones gets that from the exact process of extracting opium. Mm-hmm. Opium, a powerful narcotic, is produced from the liquid latex produced in the unripened pods of the poppy flower. And humans noticed this in Western Asia and Europe very early in history, at least 5,000 years ago. And probably just about as soon as somebody first got that sticky white goo all over their hand and thought, I wonder what this tastes like.
You know, typically when I have a sticky white glue, cut that out.
No, do it. Finish the joke.
Typically, when there's sticky white glue on my hand.
Finish the joke, Roberto.
You don't want to do anything with it. Typically, when you have sticky white glue on your hands, you don't, or if you even see sticky white glue, you don't want to touch it.
Yeah, it was 5,000 years ago. People were more curious back then. The thing is, ancient people didn't really have a great understanding of which poppy species worked and which ones didn't. Since opium poppies aren't all that common in Europe, opium itself wasn't super widespread. But poppies in general were incorporated into a lot of pre-modern medicine.
Okay, that makes sense. I see where George R. R. Martin got it from.
Yeah, the sticky white goo of the poppy flower.
I mean, in that show, they definitely love that goo.
That is the HBO promise. All this goo brings us to 1527, when a Swiss guy called Paracelsus took some Arab medical practices and some advances in distilling to create history's first known batch of laudanum.
Okay, so Paracelsus is also in Aurora's D&D game that I play with her.
Oh, that's
and they're
right.
And they are the potions master. So Aurora, I know you're listening to this. You're mentioned now.
Yeah, the guy who invented laudanum. The thing is, Paracelsus also claimed that his laudanum came from the stones of immortality in the pommel of his magical sword. So it took another 80 years or so before anybody took laudanum all that seriously. It's just a tincture of opium and alcohol, but it was first entered into serious medical practice on a wider level by an English physician called Thomas Sydenham, who said, among the remedies which it has pleased the Almighty God to give man to relieve his sufferings, none is so universal and so efficacious as opium.
Well, if he's recommending it, I guess we gotta try it. I don't know. The book says to.
Yeah, I got some right here. Just bring out a foot long pipe.
Is growing the plant still legal in the U.S.?
It is. If you grow too many of them, you will get a visit from the DEA, but you can legally grow decorative poppy flowers.
Okay. Because I know one of my favorite fillings in like Russian like pastries is poppy seeds. So
production of poppy seeds is really tightly controlled.
Yeah, I ate way too much poppy in when I was in Russia. That explains why everyone's so happy there.
Just shoveling poppy yep. seeds in. So Thomas Sydenham went on to prescribe laudanum to his patients for such conditions as pain, sleeplessness, and diarrhea. And over the following century, as it became widely available, laudanum and other opiate products were used as a general cure-all.
Okay. Oh, that's also in Deadwood, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Probably. Laudanum has been a popular drug of choice for about 400 years.
Yeah, because I remember hearing it a lot, like when I was like, "Hey, let's," or like watch like Western stuff. Like, oh yeah, oh they're just taking some laudanum, you know? Oh, you've been on it for too long. Okay.
Yeah. It's old-timey heroin, basically. Yeah. But dealing with aches, pains, and the near constant threat of shitting yourself to death in the 17th century isn't the only use for opium. Just like its medical benefits, people have probably been using the extract of poppy plants to make themselves feel good for about as long as we've lived in places where it grows. Reports of recreational opium go back to at least the Middle Ages, as do the symptoms of addiction and withdrawal.
One thing about people doesn't change, and it's that.
If you give people opium, they will get hooked on it. That is a general
rule. I mean, I live in Appalachia, you know. Here, it's, you know, it's Oxy now. Yeah,
still opium. Yep. and it's doing horrifying things to the whole country. Yeah. Naturally, opium poppies reached China well before Europeans did, showing up in the 7th century via trade with the Sassanid Persian Empire. Hey. Shout out to my other podcast, History of Persia.
And you're almost there. Just two more dynasties?
Yeah, just, you know, like 15 more years. Its medical uses were documented in Chinese sources very early on, though by the 15th century, the line between medical and recreational use might have been a little blurry. From the Ming-era writer Xu Boling, he wrote, "It is mainly used to treat masculinity, strengthen sperm, and regain vigor. It enhances the art of alchemists, sex, and court ladies. Frequent use helps to cure the chronic diarrhea that causes the loss of energy. Its price equals that of gold."
All right, guys, you heard it here on America's Secret Wars. If you want to be more masculine and be more virile, drink the sticky white goo.
Yeah, for those keeping score, sticky white goo equals more masculine with stronger sperm. Now there is logic to this. What they're actually observing here is almost certainly the fact that you can't come properly when you are on opiates, and therefore you last longer in bed.
Huh, makes sense.
So they were using opium as 15th century Viagra.
I mean, there's one thing that people, that men like to do is try to last longer. You know, it went from, you know, 10 seconds to 15 seconds, done. And everyone else is still unsatisfied.
But it's that last part about its price being equal to that of gold that gave European merchants in Guangzhou their opening. All these new colonies in places like the Americas and India included new colonial poppy farms. Driving the price of opium down in European-ruled territory, but not in China. They had finally found a cheap commodity that was worth a fortune to the Chinese.
Oh no. Beginning of the end.
The Portuguese started importing it in Macau early on, but European contact with Native Americans added another important element to the eventual opium trade, and that was smoking. Initially, widespread recreational use of opium in Europe was done by mixing a little bit of opium latex into your pipe tobacco.
Oh, that's how they did it. I'm like, did you just like put like the liquid in there and like it's like light it up from the bottom and just like have fun? Or is it?
Eventually it becomes that. Or, you know, they refine it down to a kind of a rock. But
so math.
Yeah, similar to production to crack. Like, it's effectively the way that heroin powder is produced now, just with more impurities.
Okay, so Breaking Bad, but in China.
Yeah, well, in India, and then they sell it in China. And so this, when they started bringing it into Chinese markets, also finally created the opening for tobacco.
Woo! Number one export. Go, Virginia!
Before long, people figured out that tobacco was optional in this process. And initially, opium pipes and getting absolutely blasted on narcotics was an upper-class luxury.
Oh, so we don't have, like, the Chinese... The little smoke stores yet all around the place.
Yeah, they're coming.
Okay. And so it's a poppy plant.
Early Chinese opium smokers in the mid to late 18th century adapted traditional tea ceremonies for its preparation. But by the end of that century, opium was being imported in greater and greater quantities, driving the price down and opening access to people from all walks of life. Whole businesses, the infamous opium dens, started forming around this brand new addiction. They ranged from inordinately fancy to simple shacks, depending on the class of their patrons.
Well, you know, these European sentence people, they're not sending their best. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing these problems with us. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime. And somebody who are good people.
It's unfortunate how well that works. I know. Because we are like a paragraph or two from people forming an illegal cartel.
Called it.
So by 1729, the opiate crisis in China was such a problem. The Yongzheng Emperor issued a full prohibition of issued a full prohibition of recreational opium use in China and ordered his ministers to confiscate and destroy opium imports. Call it a war on drugs.
You know, I've heard of those. They don't work well usually, do they?
You know, this one might have worked better if drugs didn't have a British Empire on their side.
Yeah. Damn Brits, ruining everything.
So there was a bit of a problem with the Emperor's plan in 1729, and that problem talks like this in it.
Oh, my God, right in it. Get a bottle of water, a bottle of opium.
Yeah, so the British had come, and more accurately, the British East India Company.
Oh, no.
Which had, as a corporation distinct from their government, conquered large swaths of India. And by 1764, they had seized most of the South Asian subcontinent to include the massive poppy fields of Bengal and northeastern India, where they claimed a legal monopoly and an effective monopoly on the whole opium trade in all of Asia. Somewhat famously, the British didn't really take no for an answer in colonial trade policy. And the East India Company began operating a massive smuggling operation into China despite the prohibition.
Well, I am going to say Peter the Great died a year before this thing happened. Darn.
Were you going to find a way to blame it on Peter the Great?
Yes. But no, I can't. He's dead.
Well, in 1783, a few decades later, a weird little thing happened one Pacific Ocean and most of a North America away. The United States became a real independent country that had to start having its own economy.
Oh, what a shame.
Well, in 1784, the U.S. sent our first diplomatic consul to Guangzhou, though they were not formally received as diplomats by the Chinese government.
I kind of want to know, who was this person? Is it someone we know or famous?
No, I don't even know if their name was mentioned in the book that I was
reading. Unnamed person. I like those people.
Yeah. Some minor founding father was sent to China in 1784.
I'm going to call him, let's go with John Smith. That sounds like a nice American name.
That's always a reliable option. One benefit of not being wrapped up in European politics anymore was that the United States could freely trade with the Ottoman Empire, another of the world's leading opium producers. Ottoman dope was lower quality than the Indian version, but it was so cheap that that didn't really matter. It allowed the newborn United States to gain a foothold in Chinese trade, and trans-Pacific merchants became some of America's first millionaires. If only more of them had died at sea.
You know, I if only they had gone underwater and just got crushed by pressure.
Yeah, we needed, you know, a couple of guys did that during the American Revolution. They didn't get crushed. I think the sub punctured and they just, their brains imploded.
Still counts.
Yeah. Submarines, don't go in them. They're like helicopters. Tension over the opium issue increased in 1799 when the Jiaqing Emperor made importing opium even under the guise of medical use illegal and cracked down on smuggling rings. But there is a funny thing about opiates.
I can see where the problems are starting.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. Opiates, real fucking addictive. And if huge swaths of your population are already hooked, making them illegal doesn't make the problem go away. It just means that more people are going to find them illegally.
But that's illegal.
America, are you listening?
Sorry, what did you say? I didn't hear that.
Oh, I said continue imprisoning people for becoming addicted to a substance you helped get them addicted to.
Oh, yeah, I understand that.
Yeah, this message goes out to the VA. This was a part of a larger campaign against Western influence as in general. In 1811, the Jiaqing Emperor also oversaw a new legislation to outlaw Christianity, specifically to combat the huge number of Catholic Jesuit missionaries converting his subjects. Missionaries were sentenced to death, and Chinese Christians who refused to renounce their new religion were sold as slaves to Uyghur Muslims in the Western territories.
How things have changed with the Uyghurs.
Yeah, well, now the Chinese can effectively actually, like, project military power there.
Yeah, true.
They paid tribute at this point, but China didn't really govern modern Xinjiang.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And then, you know, China just giving the Christians what they want. More martyrs.
Yeah, Christianity is still sort of new. You don't quite realize just how much that works in their favor. But don't worry, today's story is going to involve the wackiest Christianity in world history.
Yeah, Manichaeism?
Oh no, way, way weirder. I promise. You, if you don't already know about it, you will not see it coming.
I think I do, because I met someone who was that denomination in Georgia last May.
It is not a denomination that still exists for a reason.
Okay. Never mind. It was still a weird thing.
Yeah. So you can imagine persecuting Christians didn't exactly ease tensions, even if the primary opium smugglers were Protestants at this point. Fast forward, the U.S. and Britain have themselves a war of 1812, and when diplomatic and military tensions eased, the American presence in Guangzhou exploded. And by 1830, five of the largest trading houses in the city were run by American companies. The largest of these was Russell & Company. And in 1833...
That sounds familiar.
Well, this is going to sound familiar. They hired an interesting little guy named Warren Delano Jr. to work in their Guangzhou office. Roberto, does anything about Warren's name jump out to you?
Delano?
He was, in fact, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's grandfather. He was also a descendant of Philip Delano, one of the original Pilgrim colonists in Massachusetts. Basically, American aristocracy as deep as it can go, but not wildly rich yet.
So, funnily enough, I actually have a deep disdain for FDR. And just because I hate him as a person, you know, some of his things I liked, but like, okay, as a person, I just hate him so much.
You know, he was led us through the darkest hour. He was also president of the United States. You can't be a good person and have that job.
No. He married his cousin.
Yeah, but it was before 1980, so nobody really cared.
Yeah, no, I like Teddy. He's my favorite. I don't like FDR too much.
See, I feel like Teddy's an objectively worse person.
Oh, no, absolutely.
He's more fun to read about.
Exactly. He's way more fun. He's objectively worse, but he's way more fun.
Yeah, okay. So those were on that page.
Yeah.
So he wasn't rich yet, but Russell & Co. had an arrangement with Wu Bingjian, who went by the name Haokua in his dealings with Western businesses.
Give him a nice Haokua.
And yeah, I wrote this before that. Yeah. Warren and Wu Haokua worked very closely, secretly unloading Ottoman opium in floating offshore warehouses before coming into port with the legitimate goods. Warren thus became incredibly wealthy off of this deal, as did many Americans with similar arrangements. Warren Delano, in particular, rose to become the head partner of Russell & Company and sell opium to the Union Army during the American Civil War. Basically what I'm saying...
That's why I know it.
Yeah. Basically what I am saying is that FDR was probably born and certainly became president because of a massive drug smuggling operation run by his grandfather.
So drugs built America is what I'm hearing. Because we selling drugs to the Union soldiers, we had a bunch of super high Union soldiers fighting them Johnny Rebs.
Well, I think the opium was more for, you know, while they're sawing your leg off, you will only feel most of it.
Yeah. Makes sense.
The barber who just finished cleaning a toilet comes in with a rusty saw and cuts off your leg. You're going to want some opium. So by the 1830s, the British alone were selling over 1,400 tons of opium in China every year.
That's a lot of opium.
And that's not accounting for the American trade.
Oh, they're hooked.
Yeah, through all of this, the Qing government was hesitant to crack down on opium trafficking directly because it allowed for gold and silver to be laundered back to the government. Merchants would hoard precious metals and use it to buy opium. The white traders would then sail into port and use that money to buy legitimate goods, paying massive taxes and tariffs to do business in Guangzhou, which could then be siphoned back to the government.
Would you look at that? The government enjoying the illegal drug trade benefits.
Yep, never happened again.
Nope, not like the CIA selling cocaine in Colombia.
I don't have a document in this folder labeled Contras. As addiction drove up demand for opium, the balance shifted, and China entered into a trade deficit with the British Empire, buying more opium than they were making money back in legitimate trade. Rampant addiction and its consequences, continuing presence of Christian mercenaries, or of Christian missionaries, similar but different, the threat of economic collapse, and several diplomatic incidents with the British finally pushed China over the edge. In 1838, the Daoguang Emperor appointed a Confucian scholar named Lin Zexu to eradicate opium use in China. Zexu wrote a letter to Queen Victoria, apparently under the impression that the British also had a prohibition on opium. They did not.
That's a funny one.
Yeah, he seemed to think that they were only poisoning China when they were, in fact, equally poisoning themselves. But even if they had, the plea to halt opium trafficking would have to have fallen on deaf ears. Slinging dope in China was an integral part of the overall British imperial economy.
Well, obviously, you get to trade with China, that means you're not going to stop doing what you're doing. That's more money, no matter how you do it.
Oh, sure.
And now that we have a trade deficit, even better.
First of all, it would risk cutting Britain off of their tea, and you can't have that. But other than that, most of what Europe imported from China was still considered luxury goods. So it wasn't occupying a critical niche in the British economy. But in Britain, their own industrialization had driven down the demand for Indian cotton. And that functionally eradicated the demand for handmade textiles being made in Indian workshops.
Time for more poppy.
The colonial administration encouraged out-of-work Indians to work on poppy fields, which meant that the British were trading their domestic output to India for opium, and to be able to make the opium profitable, they needed to sell opium in China. Lin Zexu was threatening to collapse the entire British economy for the whole empire.
Yeah, I can see where issues may come up from that.
So, Zexu banned the sale of opium and drug paraphernalia in all of its forms outright. He seized the opium stockpiles in the illegal warehouses, and he closed the Pearl River Channel, both preventing new merchants from entering Guangzhou and stopping anybody who was already in the city from leaving.
So what did he do with the stockpile? Did he just, like, light it up, if you know what I mean, or...
They piled it, all of it, the actual opium, the drug paraphernalia, everything confiscated from various opium dens, and just torched it all on the beach.
Hey, I was right!
I'm imagining people got an incredible one last contact high.
Woo-wee! I'm feeling good!
Almost 1,500 tons of opium was confiscated and publicly destroyed at the same time in May of 1839. That is more than they imported annually from the British Empire.
That's a hell of a ton of opium.
So that should give you some perspective of how much was coming in through other channels.
That is a lot of opium. I think people are upset after this.
Yeah. 2 months later, a fight between British sailors and a Chinese villager in Kowloon, which is now part of Hong Kong, resulted in a diplomatic incident that caused Lin Zexu to ban selling food to British people.
I mean, you've seen what they eat.
True, but they prefer to eat something over nothing.
True.
A month after that, a British merchant ship was attacked by pirates, but a rumor spread through British ranks that it was actually a Chinese attack, possibly because the Qing government convinced the Portuguese to ban British ships from Macau on the same day.
Sure. Look for an excuse to start a war.
But, you know, I ban all of my cult-like followers from buying all Coca-Cola products until they reintroduce Coke Cinnamon.
I'm bringing Coke Cinnamon Zero so I can drink it.
See, there is an interest in the product, Coca-Cola. Get this spiced shit off the shelves and bring back the one true beverage.
Africa is a land with endless stories to tell. From epic battles, brilliant rulers, and the dramatic rise and fall of civilizations, join us on the History of Africa podcast to learn the oft-ignored stories of the African continent. From the sands of Cairo to the plains of Zimbabwe, and from the mountains of Ethiopia to the forests of the Congo, find the History of Africa podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
We are back. China and the United Kingdom have been ramping up tensions in 1839. And by the end of the week after their fight over Macau, the first British warship arrived and the first opium war had begun.
Dun, dun, dun.
We don't really need to worry much about the specifics of that war today, as the United States mostly stayed out of it. Despite having some significant merchant presence in East Asia at this point, we still hadn't really gotten the Navy out there. And even though I have found references to attacks on individual Americans in China at the time, these mostly seem to have been random acts of prejudice against Westerners in general, and I can't find any details about them. The exception is the so-called Nirbuda incident. Or Nirbuda? I don't know. This happened in 1842. In March of the previous year, the British troop transport ship HMS Nirbuda crashed into a reef north of Taiwan, carrying 243 Indian conscripts, 29 Brits, and 2 Spanish observers from Manila. The Europeans and 3 Indian officers rowed to land in a launch boat, while the others spent 5 days attempting to escape by raft.
Why did it take 5 days?
Because they had to build rafts from the wreckage of their own boat without sinking the boat.
Oh. Oops.
Yeah. Only about 150 of the 240 conscripts and camp followers made it to shore, and they were all immediately captured by the Qing government. The HMS Nimrod was sent to rescue the survivors, offering a ransom for each one, but the Chinese turned them down. The Nimrod shelled Keelung, Taiwan in retribution, but couldn't actually land to do anything about it.
Ah, it feels like one of the, when your like navy is like in Civ is like bombarding, and you forgot to bring in your landing, your melee unit,
or just any ranged unit in a civilization game.
Like, oh, you can keep attacking, but you can't do anything about it.
So 6 months later, another ship, the British brig Anne, ran aground off of Da'an, Taiwan, carrying a motley crew of 34 Indians, 14 white Europeans and Americans, 5 Chinese crew, and 4 Malaysians.
That's the most diverse British ship you ever see.
Yeah, at this point in time, ships in East Asia tended to have really diverse crews.
Makes sense.
But knowing that they would be imprisoned if they were caught, the shipwreck survivors tried to steal a Chinese junk, but got caught in a storm and pushed back into the harbor.
Okay, okay. What's a junk? Is it a type of ship or?
Yeah, a junk is a Chinese ship. It's what you picture if you picture a Chinese sailing ship. Those kind of boxy, tapered ship.
Like the flat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With a flat top, a big square sail.
Yeah, okay. Got it.
So after being pushed back into the harbor, the survivors of the Anne were also captured, and in every case, the local Qing commander claimed that he took the captives in battle, and that they had attacked local fishermen in order to hype himself up to the emperor.
Yes, I fought valiantly for you, my emperor. I just didn't find these men.
By capturing starving shipwreck survivors.
They just look like that.
Yeah. Well, following a disastrous Chinese defeat at Ningpo, the emperor sent approval to execute all of the captives being held on Taiwan.
That's a war crime.
Well, it was 1839, and those hadn't really been invented yet.
That too.
They spared 8 officers, 6 of whom were white, 1 of whom was Indian, and 1 who was Chinese.
Damn, white privilege strikes again.
All from the brig called the Anne. 87 captives had already died from poor prison conditions and abuse by their guards, and the remaining 197 captives, largely Indian conscripts from the British military, were beheaded on August 10th, 1842.
That must have been a huge headache.
1 Chinese sailor was kept on in Taiwan to act as an interpreter, and the 8 other survivors were sent to Xiamen until the end of the war as political hostages. In July of 1842, the British reached Shenzhen, a city just outside of Beijing that was besieged and stormed by the British, allowing them to cut off the Grand Canal and the Chinese government's ability to distribute food throughout their country. The British then moved on to Nanjing, but the Qing government of the city opened negotiations, and this would ultimately end the war. But unbeknownst to either side at the time, the situation in China took a turn for the worse the day before the British arrived because of the Nabura incident.
That's the one you talked about earlier, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
This was a diplomatic crisis in the middle of the negotiation process.
Okay, that makes way more sense now. Got it.
Yeah, but it also resulted in American sailors being among the executed.
Oh, ooh. What did America have to say about that?
We couldn't really say anything at the time because we had no military or diplomatic presence to speak of.
Okay.
We would have opinions a minute later.
Got it.
It is probably a good thing that they didn't know that a bunch of their soldiers had just been decapitated in prison, because that probably would have tanked the negotiations at Nanjing.
I can see how that would do that, yeah.
The part of the First Opium War that is most worth mentioning, though, because it influences how the second one will be fought, comes down to a quote from Hugh Gough, then a major general and later a field marshal viscount, who said, "The Chinese are robust, muscular fellows, and no cowards. The Tartars desperate, but neither are well commanded nor acquainted with European warfare. Having had, however, experienced three of them, I am inclined to suppose that a Tartar bullet is not a whit softer than a French one."
Ah, the Tartars. Can't wait to talk about them.
Well, what Hugh is referring to here is the difference in military history and technology between the British and the Chinese. The Tartars in this case are the Qing themselves, because they are Manchurian.
Oh, okay, yeah, because they come from the nomadic steppe region.
Right, they are Eastern steppe nomads, therefore Europeans call them Tartars.
That's confusing. There's so many freaking Tartars everywhere.
Yeah, it's like it's a word that doesn't mean much.
Yeah, because I have to deal with like the Crimean Tartars, the Kazan Tartars, and it's like literally it's a Republic of Tartarstan.
It just means steppe people, basically.
Ah, so confusing.
So the Qing dynasty had armed about a third of its own soldiers with matchlock muskets and shotguns, while the rest of the army carried polearms, swords, or bow and arrow. They did have plenty of heavy artillery, but it wasn't nearly as accurate as their European counterparts. And by contrast, the British were armed entirely with early rifles, many featuring percussion caps and loaded with more consistently formulated gunpowder. Basically, the British had more guns, which were more reliable and more accurate at a much greater range, and when huge formations of the Qing army, some 800,000 strong, charged at the British, they charged into a barrage of accurately fired artillery, and a British corps surrounded by thousands of Indian conscripts with British equipment. But when you're shooting at one another, where you're from doesn't matter a whole lot.
No, it, you know, it's just sending the Chinese people to die.
And this is all because colonial powers never traded their best weapons of war with other peoples, and the Qing dynasty was used to fighting rebels, and even more medievally armed Turkic Khanates or Tibetan armies. It had been a very long time since the Chinese went to war with a military power on their own level. Meanwhile...
or above, it seems like.
Yeah, well, meanwhile, European empires had been doing nothing but fighting one another at home and in their colonies for almost half a millennium. So they were constantly fine-tuning the best way to murder other Europeans. And most recently, the British had been dealing with Napoleon.
Who's that?
Some French guy who conquered everywhere. You'll meet him someday in Russia.
I'm sure he'll leave pretty quickly. He'll get cold or something.
but fighting Napoleon required inventing more complex tactics than charge the enemy with long sticks.
Well, yes. Actually, side tangent, I'm distantly related to Napoleon through one of his bastards in Spain.
You and every other person of Spanish descent.
Yes.
No, we swear we have a paper trail. No, don't ask me where it is. It's with my deceased great-grandmother.
I took a DNA test. That's how I found out. Because they're trying to find out if one of his like bastard sons is actually one of his bastard sons. So did a DNA test with one of his brother's descendants, and there's a match. So
interesting.
It's possible we're in the same haplogroup, whatever that means.
I hate that word. Studying Persia has made me despise the word haplogroup. All right, moving on before I go on a rant.
Yeah.
In 1842, the First Opium War ended with the Treaty of Nanking, which was enhanced by another treaty a year later. In 1844, the U.S. and France signed similar treaties, although the British still received some exclusive trading benefits through their own dealings.
Because, of course they do.
Yeah, they fought the war.
Yeah, exactly.
That seems like a fair thing for them to argue, even if the whole deal is unfair.
Mm-hmm.
The first Sino-American treaty, the Treaty of Wangxia, gave American citizens the right to be tried by their local consulate under American law for crimes committed on Chinese soil. It fixed tariffs and the right to buy land in all five of the ports that were now open to Western trade. It gave them the right to learn Mandarin, which had been illegal for Westerners up to this point. And it granted the United States most favored nation status, basically meaning the U.S. would get access to the best tariffs and taxation rates.
Hell yeah, the opium must flow.
Well, funny thing about that, opium was not legalized.
So the Brits fought this whole damn war and didn't get it legalized.
Correct. They just got better trading deals and more places they could smuggle it into.
Ah, idiots.
None of this was a smooth process. And there was understandably some lingering animosity between the people of China and the foreign merchants swarming into their country. This actually led to the first clash between United States military forces and the Chinese.
Oh?
Though calling it a battle would be exaggerating things in the extreme.
Oh.
In 1843, the sweet little gap between the end of hostilities and the Treaty of Wangxia, there was a series of anti-Western riots in Guangzhou that included an American ship being burned in the harbor and an angry mob ransacking one of the American trade houses.
Okay, wait. This reminds me of something in the future that starts the Spanish War, Spanish-American War.
Remember the Maine?
With the ship burned in the harbor. Yeah.
Well, we are not going to declare war on China over this.
Oh.
Well, there weren't any military personnel in Guangzhou at the time. But a few months later, the USS St. Louis arrived and deployed sailors and Marines in the city to secure American businesses there and fight off the rioters. So the USS St. Louis is actually an interesting ship that might get its own, like, biographical sort of episode someday.
Is it because it's named after your city?
No, it's because it's the American ship that helped invade New Zealand.
Oh, you gotta get Trevor on for that one. No, wait. Thomas!
But yes, I have a plan for that.
Okay.
It also means New Zealand has come up in both episodes that you've been on.
Yep.
Let's see. But in this case, the St. Louis had just become the new flagship of the American East India Squadron. Listeners might be tired of me asking this, but Roberto, have you heard of the East India Squadron or the 10 or so other naval squadrons we put all over the world in the 19th century?
You know, I can most certainly say that I have not, but it sounds like a badass name.
Yeah, after the War of 1812, we set up a series of boats all over the world to guard American trade and enact reprisals for diplomatic hurt feelings.
And also to stop the British from stealing our sailors.
Yeah, they did a really bad job of that.
Well, it's the Brits. They're the naval power.
Yeah. The East India Squadron in particular was established right before the start of the Opium War in 1839. To protect American presence in the Indian Ocean and the Asian Pacific. And it just so happened to arrive in China for the first time as shit kicked off. They didn't intervene, not really their fight, and they weren't authorized to start foreign wars. But the U.S. made sure to keep a few ships between Oman and China all through the conflict. Just, you know, keeping an eye on things.
That's a long distance.
Yes, it is. And when I say a few, I do mean like 10 ships covering all that water.
That's a long distance for just 10 freaking ships. We're going to look it through the telescope and be like, yep, water.
We were not a big military at this point.
Soon.
Yeah. Now that there were official diplomatic relations between the U.S. and China, Guangzhou became the home of a near-permanent American naval base. One of their specialties in this time was pirate hunting alongside the British. Often, the squadron just didn't have enough ships to cover all of its duties, so American naval officers would hire their own ships on a temporary basis, and small crews of Americans would participate in British operations, assaulting and dismantling pirate havens along the Chinese coastline. Between 1849 and 1855, these operations sunk or captured hundreds of Chinese pirate ships.
Hmm, that's really cool.
Yeah, yeah, pirates are always a fun topic. There's just, like, they're neat.
Oh, no, I freaking love pirates. Pirate History Podcast is one of my favorites.
Then, in 1852, the East India Squadron also wound up involved in an international incident when a cargo ship carrying indentured Chinese laborers to Peru underwent a mutiny. I promise I will discuss this more in part two, but for the moment, the American cargo ship, called the Robert Bowne, effectively a slave ship, had its captain literally hacked to pieces.
Good.
When it's in, yeah, right? The indentured captives took over the ship, the tables turned, and some of the American sailors were kept alive to operate, but then they mutinied themselves, took control back, and sailed to Xiamen to return their captives.
I see this as an absolute win.
You can go home. Just stop beating us.
I wish that, like, they just captured and killed the guys right as they were coming back.
The American commissioner in the city, friend of the show, Peter Parker.
Hey, I've heard of him.
Yeah. This was the ironically named, not Spider-Man, U.S. consul in China at the time, who tried to prosecute the mutineers under American law, citing the Treaty of Nanking. Chinese judges who handled some of the cases dismissed the charges, leading to an ongoing spat when the Chinese army had to step in and free all of the indentured captives.
Good.
There was a brief military standoff at the U.S. consulate, but ultimately Peter Parker relented and decided to let the Qing government have their way.
He's not such a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, is he?
No, he is not. He is a frothing at the mouth imperialist Spider-Man.
Oh, he's a dick.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, okay, got it.
The rise of the East India Squadron and an increasing American presence in Eastern Asia did create a problem. It was all fueled, literally, by coal. The 1840s and 1850s saw the rise of the first ocean-going steamships, and since all of the coal deposits in the region were monopolized by the British and other colonial powers, American merchants in China were at a disadvantage because they had to pay higher prices to stay competitive. This led to two things: a surge in American interest in Taiwan that I covered in the last episode, and second, a race to get into Japan, prompting the Perry Expedition of 1852, which saw the United States break Japanese isolationism. That is all stuff from a few episodes back with my brother, but I wanted to point out that it is all directly tied to the Opium Wars.
So drugs caused everything.
Drugs caused everything. Mm. And that is what I am going to call the end of part one. Next time we will come back to talk about the second Opium War, but for now, Roberto, do you have any thoughts?
Damn, I knew nothing about the first, and I know nothing about the second Opium War, so I'm excited to hear more. But the fact that we have a drug war, a war on drugs going on, and we're like, actually, let's just keep, you know, selling drugs to people. And I'm like, U.S. government, you're the most hypocritical piece of shit I know.
Uh-huh.
Oh, let's go to war to start, you know, let's go to war against drugs, but let's keep selling it. Oh, I hate it so much.
Yep.
But, you know, my favorite thing is that indentured slave ship that mutinied. I like that. That was good.
Yeah, that one's cool. I'm going to, like I said, there will be a bit more on that whole system at the end of the next episode.
Nice. Nice. Can't wait to learn.
Well, this is also where you can plug your various shows. and or projects.
Alrighty, so all the things. So the first one is the history of Sacramento, Georgia, where we look at Georgian history from the country of Georgia, starting from prehistory all the way to the modern day. We're currently in the LASIK wars, so it's all about laser beams and getting into your eyes. But actually, Rome and Persia are fighting over Zika. Trevor will get to that eventually. And then there's Tsar Power, where I rank the Russian rulers from Rurik to Putin. We're getting close to the Mongols, so that's going to be hectic and sad. And then I guess I'll just plug in the third one now, because it's coming up soon. I'm also the new co-host for Quest for Power, a show ranking all the European rulers from the fall of Rome to World War One. It's going to be so many people. I'm the audience this time, though, so this is good practice for me. So, yeah, check all those out. It's going to be fun. And listen, you know, keep listening to Trevor's shows. I'm a huge fan. We literally wore the same History of Persia shirt the same day we met.
I'll have to post that with this episode now.
Oh, yeah.
Let's see. Well, speaking of my shows, if you want to hear more of my voice for some reason, you can also find me hosting History of Persia, covering the history of ancient Iranian empires from 700 BC to 700 CE. And if you want to support either of those shows or just Hopful Media in general, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co and subscribe to get access to ad-free listening, bonus episodes, Discord access, and some other benefits. Until next time, thank you all for listening, and say no to drugs. This has been Nancy Reagan. Bye, everyone.
Ciao.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.